Well, the last 24 hours has been quite a story in my life. And those of you who know how story works knows that story can only be good if there's an intense amount of conflict. And so there has been that. Yesterday, when I was supposed to be getting on a plane, I was at the gym on a stair climber trying to work out to Enya, which doesn't work. I realized, as soon as I joined the gym, I realized that I have the most boring taste in music in all the world. And then got home, and I assumed I was flying out tomorrow, and I emailed my assistant and said, "Hey, can I get a copy of the itinerary? I haven't been able to find it." And she called me back. I went to bed at 8:30, which is what my life has come to. And my assistant woke me up and said, "Are you in Colorado?" And I said, "No, I'm not. I'm in my bed." And nobody I know would call at this late hour of 9:45. And then the story began, and you guys have been gracious, and so this has just been a wonderful experience. I'm acutely aware that there are two perspectives happening in the room right now about the book Blue Like Jazz. And one is this wonderful perspective of what God has done with that book, completely outside of me and outside of probably us too. And then the other perspective is a friend of mine, Stacy, who was actually on staff with Campus Crusade, lived in the house while I was writing the book. And so from your perspective, you're seeing this great, integritable, noble thing that took place, and God has used it. And then I'm thinking about Stacy's perspective of seeing me sitting around in my boxers typing into a computer and him knowing the truth about how all that came to be. And it's a bit humbling. But no, this is, you know, without you guys, you know, God wouldn't have got that message out. So I'm very, very thankful. My life is really just a terrific opportunity after opportunity. And when people ask, why did the book take off? I say, because of Campus Crusade for Christ. And literally because my roommate Stacy handed it to his superior, handed it to his superior, handed it to his superior, handed it to hundreds and hundreds of thousands of freshmen apparently all across the country. And so that's been wonderful. I'm very grateful. I want to talk a little bit about story and kind of how story works and the power of story. I just took an Old Testament class from a guy named John Salehammer, who's an Old Testament scholar. And some of you are familiar with his work. He's wonderful. I take a class from Salehammer every time I can. And so I just got out of that class, and we went through the Pentateuch. And the question that I had for Dr. Salehammer was, why is it that when God put together a book that explained apparently the meaning of life or the message that God wants to communicate to humanity, why did he simply tell story after story after story after story after story and almost never stop to explain what the story meant or what the story was about? It's just narrative after narrative after narrative. And even in the New Testament, you see a subtext under the epistle that is a narrative. You see, you know, in James, consider it all joy when you encounter various trials, so we know that these people are encountering trials. And then he talks about finances, so we know that the type of trial they're encountering is financial. And then he says, if you ask God for wisdom, he'll give you wisdom. So now we know that the reason that they're in financial crisis is because they weren't wise. And then he actually gives them a piece of wisdom. He says, look, isn't it the rich, you know, who drag you into court and all this stuff, and won't all their possessions be burned? And you're poor, and so none of your possessions will be burned. So if you believe that wisdom, then your crisis is over. There's a story involved in the subtext of all of these books. This is really hard for us to understand after the Enlightenment, because we're always looking for the meaning or the moral of the story. We want to know specifically, what do I do after reading this story? And God doesn't tell us. Rarely does he tell us. And a lot of times, the meaning of the story seems to have nothing to do with what I'm doing with my life. I mean, if the meaning of this story is just to present the lineage of Christ, what does that have to do with me being a more efficient cog in the wheel? Nothing. I mean, I see the Bible a lot like the instructions for an electronic toothbrush, you know? And you kind of give somebody the instruction booklet. If you've never read the instruction booklet for electronic toothbrush, it's fascinating. You give it to somebody, and you say, what do you think of this? And they say, well, this first part here, I pull from it that we should plug in our lives. And you'd kind of go, this person is absolutely nuts. The only thing that this instruction booklet is trying to do is help you understand how to work an electronic toothbrush. And so a lot of times we come to Scripture and we have to realize our lives actually have to adjust to what this book is trying to get me to understand. And if I'm trying to make this book help me live the American dream, I'm going to have to basically jump through theological hoops in order to do it. In fact, I'm just going to have to make things up. Really. The five stones that David threw represent faith, hope, love, tithe, and tithe, right? And if you just throw these five stones, then you can kill the giant in your life. Now, what's interesting about that particular exegesis of text is that God didn't say that. He didn't. He didn't come to the end of the story and said, here's my point. My point is that there are five stones, and you can get the Volvo if you just, you know, faith, hope, love, tithe, and tithe. The story is absolutely about something else. And here's the other interesting phenomenon about the Bible and the way we approach the Bible. We approach these stories differently than we approach any other stories in our lives. For instance, you know, if you guys invited me to a movie and I went with you and your friends to the movie and we saw the movie and then we were driving home and I said, hey, can we just pull the car over because I want to talk about something really important. What can we learn from Rocky? Be really honest. You would not invite me to any more movies. You really wouldn't, because that's not what movies are for. That's not what stories are actually about. Stories are doing something else. In fact, a friend of mine, Stacy, who I've talked to you about just now, Stacy Gorton is here, and he just got married recently to a wonderful girl named Holly. And she's okay. She's no, I'm kidding. She's wonderful. Stacy's mean. If you know Stacy, you don't know Stacy. Otherwise, that would be funny. Nicest guy in the world. So we're out at the Kennedy School one night before the rehearsal dinner. Some of Stacy's buddies, his groomsmen, got together, and we went out for cold pints of coffee. Is that okay? I'm not sure. It's okay. Cold pints of bitter coffee. Sin is regional, so you never know. If you're in the South, Colorado is kind of, Colorado's in between, you know, and so you never know. So we're sitting around, and we just wanted to tell stories about Stacy's life. I mean, big, huge, important day happening in the next day, and we wanted to just say, hey, here's something that I remember. And what if I would have done this? Wes was there. Wes is Stacy's brother. And what if Wes told a story about them going fishing or something like this? And kind of in the middle of the story, I interrupted Wes and said, Wes, forgive me, just one second. Where are you going with this story? What's the point? Okay, and then what can I get out of it for my life? I would probably be perceived as rude, and was, when I did that. I didn't do it. That's not what stories do. Stories do something else. I actually took a seminar, a class on story from the guru of story. The guy's name is Robert McKee. And if you've seen the film Adaptation, McKee was portrayed in this film by an actor. It's a movie with Nicolas Cage, and Nicolas Cage is a screenwriter, and he's trying to adapt a book into a film. And he goes to a Robert McKee seminar, who's a real guy, and it's a seminar. This one happened to be in New York. And McKee is probably, you know, 70 or so. He is the expert on story. I mean, he's written the Bible of story called Story, 500 pages explaining why some stories work and why some stories don't, why some stories are entertaining, why some stories are not entertaining, why some stories are meaningful, why some stories are not meaningful. And he just goes through 500 pages in tiny text and explains why. I had no idea it was this complicated. But apparently, you know, he's been teaching for a very long time, and he kind of resents the audience often. He resents that he has to, and even in the film, somebody asks a question of Robert McKee, and Robert McKee doesn't like the question, and so he yells at the student who asked the question until they're so embarrassed they have to leave the room. He's really like that. my friends who told me about his seminar and told me what to do in order to go said, don't ask questions. Don't raise your hand. Don't sit near the front. And so we show up, and my friend Jordan went with me, my roommate actually back home, Jordan. He's a young writer, and he's writing some great stuff. And so he went with me, but I didn't tell Jordan that Robert McKee had a temper problem. And so McKee seemed very nice at first, and he sort of went through. And then occasionally he would ask the question, you know, he would ask a question of the audience. Somebody call out a good story, a good movie with a car chase. And I leaned over and elbowed Jordan and said, I'll give you $5 to yell out the Passion of the Christ. Just five. $5. Jordan didn't do it. But I just thought it would be hilarious that somebody, every time McKee asked a question, somebody yelled, the Passion of the Christ, the greatest movie ever. He's something of an agnostic, too. And so anything to make him mad. So we got to see him yell at some people, and that was fun. But in his book, Robert McKee says this about story, and I just want to put it up on the screen so that we can read it. It should be the first slide. No? I may have left it on the plane. No, okay, no slide. But McKee, if it just let me know if it comes up. Oh, it was there? Oh. I saw myself and I couldn't get my eyes over anywhere else. Fascinated by me. I write books about me all the time, and I look at me and I love me. The storyteller's selection and arrangement of events is his master metaphor for the interconnectedness of all the levels of reality, personal, political, environmental, spiritual. Stripped of its surface of characterization and location, story structure reveals his personal cosmology, his insight into the deepest patterns and motivations for how and why things happen in this world, his map of life's hidden order. Story is incredibly powerful. It is much, much, much more powerful than a list. It's much more powerful than bullet points. And when God chooses to communicate ideas, he chooses almost exclusively narrative. And somebody, half of you are going, Romans, read it. Read it again. And stop pulling Reformed theology out of it. Just read it. You know, you can do that if you want. But read it. There's a narrative, and it's a passionate and crime of all crimes, it's an emotive narrative. It's very emotional. I wish I could die and go to hell, but I won't because I want to stay here for you. I mean, there's just passion in this text. When we break it down into bullet points, it doesn't work. When we do that, we separate truth from meaning. It would be like if your man was taking you out and you were at a candlelight dinner. And everything was going great, you know. And then he pulled out a piece of paper, and he just started writing on this piece of paper. And then he folded the piece of paper, and he slid it to you under the candles. And you thought, this is good. This is good. He's learning. He's figuring things out. And you open the piece of paper, and it says, 1, you are 5'6". 2, you have brown hair. 3, you know, you have blue eyes. And essentially, what he did was he wrote a list of statistics. You would probably not swoon in response to these statistics, right? And so you would say, you know, what is this? And he would say, but wait a second, this is truth. Do you have a problem with truth? Are you postmodern? Is that what's going on? You know, you're like Jell-O. I can't pin you down, you know. Is this or is this not true information? Just, you know. Doesn't get it. Shakespeare says, had I this cheek to bathe my lips upon, this hand whose touch, whose every touch would force the feeler's soul into the oath of loyalty, this object which takes prisoner the wild motion of mine eye. It means something different. When God communicates ideas, he communicates truth in the context of meaning. We have assumed that we can pull truth from meaning and get the same result. We can't. They go together. Our brains work. There are three large sections of the brain. There are many sections, the right and left brain and the amygdala. And your emotion center is actually right here in the center. It's this little walnut-shaped thing in your brain, and you feel everything because chemicals are being poured through your amygdala. When you fall in love, you are on a drug trip, a natural drug trip. You really are. It's obvious, right? And the drug that produces the feeling of love lasts for 2 years. I wish I were making this up. It actually does. It only lasts for 2 years. And then a secondary chemical is poured through the brain that causes a sweeter sensation, but less obsessive. And it's the sort of sensation where you sort of wake up and you go, this is the one. I just know. I just know. And that chemical it happens after 2 years of the first chemical being consistent. And we often think, you know, we criticize people who speak from their heart, or they tend to feel things with their heart. After the Enlightenment, we separated the human brain. We took the amygdala out of the brain and we put it here. The only thing that you feel in your heart is when you're having a heart attack. That's all. You don't feel love with your heart. You don't feel fear. None of that. Or if you're on a stair climber, then you feel with your heart. Everything else is happening in the brain. And so God understands that when he communicates ideas, he needs to communicate to the whole brain, the right side, the left side, and the amygdala. What we tend to do is have experiences based on holistic communications and then turn around and justify those experiences with lists, with, well, I'm a Christian because it makes sense for this reason, it makes sense for this reason, and this reason. Really, did you know that before you became a Christian? Or is this the justification of the experience that you had? And then we begin to assume that we can present the justification to somebody and hopefully lead them to the same experience. Not true. Not true. That's a completely different idea. God uses narrative. He uses story. I always thought story was about entertainment. You know, you just kind of go to the movies and you check out for a minute and... But I started noticing something really interesting. When I left a good movie that I really liked, I felt in my brain a kind of clarity. I mean, there was, you know, I would go in sort of foggy thinking, and then I would see this movie, and after seeing Rocky, I realized that life was about working out and beating somebody up. And it was very clear in my mind, that is what life is about. It fades after a bit of time. You begin to realize it's really about Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. But for a while, it was about working out and beating somebody up. And so story actually does work as a kind of map. I mean, we stand in the middle of it and we know, oh, this is, if I go this direction, this is not a good direction. If I go this direction, this is a good direction. And so I come over here and I stay here. And this feels intuitively like the right place to be based on the elements of story as they were presented to me. And then there are actually principles that guide a story. When you see a movie that you didn't like or you just daydream through the whole thing, there are probably reasons that took place. Some filmmakers called about a year and a half ago and wanted to make a movie out of Blue Like Jazz. And I had been offered that before and just said, have you read the book? There's cartoons in the book. There's no movie in that book. But these guys, I really trusted these guys. They'd made some good movies, and they said, what if we just gave you creative license? You could just make things up. We make up a whole story, and then we'll just put Blue Like Jazz on the poster. And I thought, you know, that is not, there's no integrity in that, and God doesn't want me to do that. And so, no. And they said, well, we'll give you this much money. And I said, come on out, fly out. Let's do this. Let's figure this out. Do you need to pray about it? No, come on. No, I'm kidding. But what really happened was we sat around my house and we started thinking, okay, is there a story in this book? And then pretty soon things were beginning to be made up. Characters who didn't exist in real life and certainly weren't. We started putting them. And then I said, you know what? I don't understand why we're taking so much that isn't true. You know, and the guys were very, they basically said, Don, we have to make your life more interesting on the screen because in real life your life is rather boring. And then they actually started learning what the principles were that made the story more interesting. So now get this weird scenario. Here we are, we're sitting in my living room, and we're using principles of story to make the fictional me more interesting and more meaningful. And the real me is not very interesting and not very meaningful. So then I start wondering, what if I use the same principles that we're using to make the story interesting to make my actual life interesting and meaningful? So that when the credits roll, people don't go, huh, as they often do, right? And here are the things that a person needs in order to guide their mind through a meaningful experience. And here's the reason I tell you. A lot of times as leaders, we tend to sort of set goals and strategies, and we have a plan for our ministry. And I wonder what it would look like to actually take a campus ministry and say, you know, this year, we're actually not going to lead ourselves toward goals. We're actually going to try to tell a story. We're just going to try to tell a story. So that at the end of the year, at the end of the semester, at the end of whatever period of time, we actually have that fulfilling experience like when you just saw a good movie. Only we didn't see the movie, we actually lived inside of the story. Story makes sense because it reflects human life. We like very clear stories because it gives us the feeling that life is clear. And if we apply those to our lives, we find that we actually have much more meaningful experiences. The first thing that has to happen, there are many, there are probably about 50, but I'm going to talk about three with you, is there has to be an ambition. There has to be a desire. A protagonist or a group protagonist, a group of people or an individual, in order to live out a meaningful story, has to want something. If they don't want something, there's no story. And if we don't want something in our lives, there's no story. And we're going to keep waking up thinking, life doesn't make sense. It just doesn't feel right. And, you know, that leads to all sorts of trouble. But as soon as we want something, our story begins to make sense. I mean, if I said to you, you know, I saw a man the other day and he was standing on the street and he was just looking at a building. That's not a very interesting story. But if I said, and then he pulled suction cups out of his briefcase and he started to climb the building, suddenly the story gets very interesting. And then I said, and a bunch of other things happened, but I wasn't that interested and I walked away. You would say, you did what? He pulled suction cups and you walked away? Why? Because there's a very interesting story. Here is somebody who wants something. Now that sounds wrong in our context, in an American context, because we have so much. I mean, would it be okay and would it be right to want something? Well, as we let story guide us, we actually figure out that stories about people who want something aren't always great. I mean, if we really analyze what we want, if we sit down with a piece of paper and say, what do I want? In other words, what story am I telling? And on the piece of paper, I write, I want a Volvo. Okay, well, that's the beginning of a story. You want a Volvo. And a story can be told about wanting a Volvo. But let's go to the end of that story. Let's go to the very end of it. Now, you've worked for 5 years, and you have your Volvo, and the credits are rolling because you just got the keys and you're driving off the car lot with your Volvo. And are people crying in the audience? Maybe Swedish people. But probably not. And there's nothing wrong with Volvos. I love them, right? But the Volvo can be what the protagonist drives, but it can't be what your story is about. Because if that's what your story is about, then it's not a very interesting story. And you won't feel any different at the end of it than you would if you watched it happen on a screen. We actually have to want something that's good. We have to want something that's really, really good. Now, here's a room full of people who want good things. You're making sacrifices because you want good things. You know, here's a good test in a story. If your protagonist dies, gets hit by a bus, and the protagonist doesn't get what he or she wanted, their dream or their ambition, what happens? I have a friend, her name is Jenna, and she runs an organization called Bloodwater Mission. Jenna just turned 25 years old, and I was hanging out with Jenna in Nashville, and we had dinner on her 25th birthday. There were a group of us there, And it just occurred to me, Jenna's goal is to build 1,000 freshwater wells in Africa. She's built over 70 so far. She wants to build 1,000 of them. And I realized that, God forbid, if Jenna were to walk out this restaurant and get hit by a bus and die, hundreds of thousands of people would die. She's 25 years old, weighing in about 105. That is an incredibly important protagonist in a story. Incredibly important. And then I turn to myself and I say, Dom, what would happen if you died? Book sales would go up. Not the best story. We might need to work on this a little bit. So that's part of the Belmont Foundation, starting the Belmont Foundation. Here's the second thing that has to happen in a good story. This has to happen. And it's not fun. Conflict. Conflict has to happen in order for a story to be good. If I said to you, I got a great story. Yesterday I got on my plane, it landed at 321, or it took off at 321, landed here, got my rental car, went to the hotel, and I showed up 4 hours ahead of time to this conference. You would think, okay, is there a story that's going to start here? Conflict has to happen. Everything is conflict. The only way our characters are changed is through conflict. Joy means nothing. Joy doesn't change you. Conflict changes us. The elements of story are taught to us in such a strange way here in America because there are principles, there are guiding forces, there are positive and negative polar charges that we learn and we write our stories within these charges. The biblical positive and negative charges have to deal with heaven and hell, have to deal with eternity, have to deal with love, have to deal with loneliness. And we write Christian stories within those positive and negative charges. But those aren't the dominant positive and negative charges being taught to us in our culture. The dominant positive and negative charges being taught to us in our culture are actually commercial. 3,000 commercials a day the average American sees. 3,000 images or messages that says, if you spend this much money on this product, you will be happy. And so the positive and negative charges that the average American uses to write their story have more to do with Bed Bath & Beyond than going to China. We've just learned this is what writing a good story is about. This is what I'm supposed to do with my life. I'm supposed to work really hard and save up enough money to buy something, and then I won't be unhappy. There's very little conflict in that story. If God is writing a story through you or for you, it's going to have an awful lot of conflict. Guaranteed. It's promised. Consider it all joy when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. Conflict will happen. There's this misnomer in Christian circles that, well, I really want to do this and I prayed about it, but a door closed and so I knew that's not what God wanted me to do. No. If the door closes, then the story is going to be better at the end. I mean, can you imagine if Jenna, she's learning 5 African languages right now so she can communicate with the indigenous people of Africa that she's building villages for. 25 years old, she's learning 5 African languages. Can you imagine if she said, well, we want to build a well there, but they don't speak English. So God has closed a door. No, there's going to be tension. You know, what's amazing is the story that took place last night and today. It was great when I was at the gym, but the very beginning of the story, Don, you missed a flight, right, was nothing but conflict until about 10 minutes ago. The whole thing was conflict. All of it was conflict. The conflict never subsided. They wouldn't open the door on the plane when we got here. I couldn't find the ride at the airport. I kept going to the wrong side of the airport. And we're talking on the phone. We're literally 20 feet apart. We couldn't find each other. So we're on different floors. What a great story. Painful to live in. No, there's going to be conflict. So if we want a great story, we choose an ambition that's good. We choose an ambition that's sacrificial. And then we understand as soon as we do that, there's going to be an awful, awful lot of conflict. It's going to happen. It's going to be really difficult. And when it comes, we embrace it. We say, this is going to make my story great. I actually talked to a friend recently on a plane. A guy was sitting next to me, and he was talking about, we just met, so we were talking, and he was telling me a little bit about his wife, and they've been married for about 5 years. And there was some tension in their marriage and their relationship. And, you know, so I didn't probe or anything. I just asked a few more questions, and he kind of went into it. And he ended that the whole sort of monologue there by saying, I think I've come to the point where I've realized it's not worth fighting for. I thought, man, that is so, 5 years, you know, that's a very sad thing. And I said to him, I said, you know, sometimes it's only worth fighting for after you've fought for it. That's when you realize it was worth fighting for. In the middle of it, you just want out. Or it's not conflict. You really just want out. But we only value the things that come to us very difficultly. I was in Peru just a couple months ago, and we hiked the Inca Trail. Some friends of mine and I, some childhood friends of mine and I, got together. And the Inca Trail is 26 miles. 9 miles of the 26 miles is stairs. All of it is above 9,000 feet. It was excruciatingly difficult. And there was a point at the beginning, we're about 5 miles in, when our guide Carlos said, we're looking down on these ancient Inca ruins, and off to the right is the Sacred Valley, and we're in the Andes, right? Just beautiful mountain range. And Carlos said, if we went to the right, we could be at Machu Picchu in 6 hours. But if we go to the left, it'll take us 4 more days, and we'll go over 3 mountain passes. The big one is 13,800 feet. And I thought to myself, why don't we go to the right? I didn't know that you could go to the right. Let's go to the right. So my friends and I pushed Carlos off the ledge, and we went to the right. No, but here's the interesting thing that Carlos said. He said the Inca Trail actually goes to the left and goes these 26 miles because the Inca people wanted people to go the long way to get to their city because they knew if they went the long way over 9 miles of stairs and 3 mountain passes that when they got there, they would appreciate it. Isn't that amazing? Have you ever wondered why men and women are so different? And we just don't understand each other. It's hard, hard work. Why? Because God wants us to appreciate each other. He wants us to work hard and experience conflict. Last thing that needs to take place in a story, in order for the story to make sense to our sensibilities, is resolution. The story ends, right? And here's the interesting thing about resolution. You don't have to win. It doesn't have to happen. There's a great movie a few years ago called Friday Night Lights. It's actually about a football team in the state of Texas. And I grew up in Texas, and I love Texas football tradition. It's just so wonderful. And there was this team, and the movie was about their year and all the trouble that they went through in order to get to the national championship. And the movie ends, actually, they're on the 1-yard line. It's fourth down. There's about 2 seconds left on the clock. They have one more chance to put it in the end zone and win the game. Now, we've been with these players for 2 hours watching them try to get to this place. The quarterback snaps the ball. The running back runs wide left, and the whole line just gets stood up and backed up into the running back, and they tackle him. And they lose the game. And the credits are rolling as you're watching players and families weep. And I'm sitting here going, I can't believe they lost the game. 2 hours have been in this movie, and they lost. And yet it was one of the better movies I'd seen in years. And I couldn't exactly tell why. And then I read an interview with the producers, and it turns out that very football team in real life went to the national championship, lost in the last second of the game. The very next year, they went all the way back to the national championship and won it. And they made a movie about the year they lost. And when he was asked, why would you make a movie about the year the team lost? He said, because they tried harder. And so that was the better story. And it really was. It's the better story. You don't have to end well. But listen, if we don't try, I mean, if we don't give it everything, and it's risky. It's really, really scary. The stuff you guys are doing on campuses is frightening. We just keep plugging away, taking a group of people through a great story toward an ending, giving it everything that we've got. The truth about story and the responsibility of us as Christians, is the story in America is in decline. I probably walk out of about 30% of the movies that I go see. And it's because I don't care about what the protagonist cares about. I don't identify with his vision or her vision for what they want with their lives. Whatever reason. And Robert McKee, the guru guy of story, he actually agrees. He says, story in America is in decline. We're not writing as good of stories as we used to write. And here's a guy who's an agnostic, and he actually explains in his book why the stories in America aren't as good anymore. I just want to read you this paragraph. Slide 2, if you could. McKee says this, the final cause of the decline of story runs very deep. Its values, the positive and negative charges of life, are at the soul of our art. The writer shapes story around a perception of what's worth living for and what's worth dying for, what is foolish to pursue, the meaning of justice, truth, the essential values. In decades past, writer and society more or less agreed on these questions, but more and more, ours has become an age of moral and ethical cynicism, relativism, and subjectivism, a great confusion of values. As the family disintegrates and sexual antagonisms rise, who, for example, feels he understands the nature of love? And how, if you do have a conviction, do you express it to an ever more skeptical audience? The erosion of values has brought with it a corresponding erosion of story. Without the positive and negative charges that I believe are biblical and that the Christian brings to the world, story begins to erode. And it's not just story, it's people's lives. They begin to not make sense. Because all of us, whether we like it or not, everybody in this audience is a storyteller. We're telling stories with our lives. Every day is another scene that we say. And when we tell stories with our lives, we actually add to the positive and negative charges of the people around us. And so if I tell a story about saving a bunch of money and getting a Volvo, then the people, my friends, they learn that story is about saving up a bunch of money and getting a Volvo. And so they live more boring stories because I've helped them and set the charges for them to live a more boring story too. I have a friend whose daughter is in junior high, and she kind of got into this sort of gothic phase thing and was just doing all sorts of stuff she wasn't supposed to be doing. And he and I got together about a year ago, and he said, he was telling me about this. And he was saying, you know, I'm not a parent, so I don't know, but he was just very frustrated with his daughter. She's dating a guy that he doesn't approve of. They found pot in her room, and so his tactic is to yell at her and make her go to church. This is how he's going to fix it. And so I've been thinking about all this stuff, and I actually just, he's a good friend, and so I was able to say, you know, I don't think that yelling at her and making her go to church is going to do it. I actually think that she's attracted to a different story than the one you're telling. And he was clueless. What do you mean? I said, well, think about it. She wants to be wanted. She wants risk. She wants adventure. She wants all these things. And Deuter, Gothic Deuter, is telling a better story than you are. It's not a story that any of us like, but it's better than yours. Yours is boring. The story that you're telling her is she's a little girl who thinks she's about to cause her parents' divorce. She just chose a different role. And so I sort of explained to him, you know, here's kind of how story works. You have to have an ambition. It has to be good. And people get caught up in it. I mean, as soon as you have an ambition that's good in a multi-protagonist story, people are drawn. I mean, it's just like a good story where I say, and the dude pulled out suction cups and started climbing the building. And everybody just goes, and on your campus, as you start telling a great story, people just sort of go, what's that? What's going on over, what's this? And so he goes home. And after about a week, he sort of did some research. He pulls his family together, and he said he has a daughter and a son and his wife. And he did not talk to any of them about this. He should have, but he didn't. Stories sometimes move forward sloppily. And he said, I've found this village in Mexico that needs an orphanage. And the orphanage is going to cost $25,000. And here's what happens. Here's what will happen to the kids in this village if they don't have this orphanage. And he described some of the terrible things that will happen to the kids there. And he said, I believe that our family should build that orphanage, and we should do it within 2 years. I strongly believe that this is what we need to do. I'm going to do it. Hun, will you do this? And she's thinking, what in the world are you talking about? They're mortgaged up to their necks. They have no money. And then he pulls out a whiteboard, and he looks at his family, and he says, any ideas on how we might do this? And that meeting didn't go well. But a few days later, the family starts talking about it, and the son realizes, well, we should visit this village. If we're going to build an orphanage, we should know what we're dealing with. And so he starts filling out everybody's application for passports. Within a couple weeks, the daughter breaks up with the guy and says, Dad, I got this MySpace page. Maybe I could tell my friends about it. Maybe we could raise some money, or we could just gather resources this way. She breaks up with the dude. He's pacing in his driveway, and he's calling me. You won't believe what is happening at my house. And you know what happened in her life, in the little girl's life? She just found a better role to play in a better story. And no girl in that story, if that were a movie, that girl would not date that dude. Nothing against gothic losers, really, nothing. They have a right to tell their stories. But you'd never see a hero date him. And so her whole identity changes based on the role that she's playing in a story. And her life completely changes because they're trying to do something good. And it's extremely hard, and it's going to cost them. And if the resolution isn't good, it's going to be hard for those kids. But they're going to try. And they're going to do it. And now their life is like a page turner in a book, right? And you say to them, hey, guys, there's a story with a lot less conflict. It's about a Volvo. They say, are you kidding me? I got to figure out how this thing ends, right? And so as campus directors, we guide people through stories. And the stories that we tell have biblical positive and negative charges. And we shape the people around us to change their positive and negative charges so that they tell better stories. And pretty soon, all of us are telling much better stories. I want to close with just a quote from Robert McKee. Here's an agnostic. And so my prayer for you guys is this last paragraph in his book. Joseph is a wild donkey. Wrong one. In the 55-minute version of this, we actually open the Bible. But, you got plenty of Bible. He says this. He ends his book with this paragraph. Write every day, line by line, page by page, hour by hour. Do this despite fear. McKee assumes that I promise you, the second you write your ambition down and realize what it is, you're going to get scared. You are. You're going to get scared. That's the conflict. That's the greatness of the story. Push through it. Do this despite fear. For above all else, beyond imagination and skill, what the world asks of you is courage. Courage to risk. Courage to risk rejection, ridicule, and failure. As you follow the quest for stories told with meaning and beauty, study thoughtfully, but write boldly. Then, like the hero of the fable, your dance will dazzle the world. I bring this to you because I want to thank you for telling such amazing stories. In the community of evangelicals in America, you are radically shaping our positive and negative charges. Continue. We're fascinated. You're more interesting than television. You really are. And better looking. Father, thank you for this organization and for this group of people, this multi-protagonist story that has been unfolding for years and years and years and will continue to unfold for years and years and years. Help us create stories and tell them with our lives that set the positive and negative charges around us. God, thank you for being a storyteller, and thank you for making us characters within the story that you are telling. Help us be the good guys in the story. The humble ones, the gracious ones, the kind ones, to be the kind of characters that we love in stories, the courageous ones, the fearless ones, the bold ones. Father, bless us as we, day by day, write our stories for you to read, so that in the climactic scene of each of our lives, we would stand before you and you would say, well done, my good and faithful servant. That's where we're heading. We praise you, God, in Jesus' name. Amen.